Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable on this Wednesday, the 23rd of July. Very nice to have you with us. And I just want to inform you that for the next 2 hours, we're just going to play Ozzy Osbourne and Black Sabbath.
Yes.
That's all we're going to do. And in memory. No, not really, but it was talked about.
It would be a good 2 hours.
That's right. Absolutely. We're going to, of course, Ozzy Osbourne passed away yesterday at the age of 76, died on Tuesday. A heavy metal music icon, a guy who basically set the mold for reality television. And had been dealing with Parkinson's disease for quite a while, and just 2 weeks ago had his farewell concert, and passed away after he had announced his retirement over at various times in the latter years of his life, and then finally said this was it and passed away yesterday. So we will remember Ozzy Osbourne through his music this morning. I think whenever on public radio you can play Ozzy Osbourne and have a reason, well, damn it, you should do it. Also, we'll talk about it as a subject matter a little bit later on. Welcome to the program. We would love to have you be a part of it. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And we'd love to hear from you and hear what is on your mind this morning. Please keep your letters short and to the point. That way we can get to as many as possible. Let me introduce the group to you. We have a fantastic panel, and I want to tell you who they are. We begin with Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, is here. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Joe. Special shout out to Ozzy Osbourne, and certainly who thought that Crazy Train would become the global anthem of our world? Also, two other notes. One is that the final concerts that they just played a couple weeks ago,
yeah,
they raised over $190 million, and they donated it all to both Parkinson's research and to Children's Hospital, which is more than our Congress and President have done. So he went out with an amazing concert, but also showed his continued humanity.
Good information and two good shots in there, too.
Yes.
This is very nice.
It's early. And Joe, today, I would be remiss, though, Joe, today is Gorgeous Grandma Day. And to all of our grandmas listening, I know anybody who listens to WAMC is a gorgeous grandma. So I hope you have a wonderful day.
I mean, there's no such thing but, right?
Exactly.
A gorgeous grandma.
Well, especially WAMC listeners.
Well, that's true. Very, very true. Bob, welcome. Very nice to have you here. Professional speaker. Speaking coach and Albany County legislator Mark Grimm joins us. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
It's good to be with all of you.
Wonderful to have you on the program, as always. We welcome Catherine Tan, who is an associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College, and we welcome you back. How are things?
Oh, you know, it's summer break for Congress and myself. So things are going great.
Well, good. I'm glad you get a chance to come up and join in on our fun, and we thank you for schlepping up and for doing that. Well, speaking of summer fun, the House is so excited to get ready for their summer fun. They have cut short House business and are starting the summer session early. Speaker Mike Johnson announced on Monday that he was cutting short the week's legislative business and sending the House home early to celebrate summer and to avoid having to hold votes on releasing files related to the accused sex trafficker, Jeffrey Epstein. Mr. Johnson's move will, for now, deny Democrats the chance to force procedural votes that would call on the Justice Department to make the information public. It reflected how deep divisions among Republicans on the matter have paralyzed the House, where GOP lawmakers are trying to avoid another politically perilous vote on an issue that is confounding President Trump and roiling his MAGA base. We're done being lectured on transparency, Mr. Johnson said at a news conference where the typically unflappable speaker appeared, well, flappable. As he wrapped up his final news conference before a summer recess that was to have begun on Friday and lasted until September, Mr. Johnson complained about endless efforts to politicize the Epstein investigation. You will remember that just 10 days ago, Speaker Johnson said that this must be investigated and more files needed to be released. But his decision to shut down the House early was the latest example of how the Speaker has in many ways ceded the chamber's independence in order to please or avoid angering Mr. Trump. He has deferred to the president on matters large and small, including when it comes to Congress's spending power. He quickly maneuvered this year to yield the House's ability to weigh in on Mr. Trump's tariffs in order to spare the Republicans from having to cast politically tricky votes on whether to end them. In the case of the Epstein files, House Republicans are once again surrendering their institutional autonomy to appease a vengeful president, afraid to cross Mr. Trump, but equally fearful of right-wing supporters who were demanding the release of the material. They chose to simply pack up and go home. Bob Griffin.
You know, Joe, if it wasn't so serious, this would seem like a Monty Python skit of, you know, Runaway. I know the speaker blamed the Democrats, and certainly the Democrats have been taking full advantage of the whole Epstein scandal. But I think what the speaker didn't talk about is the fact that it was a revolt within his own leadership that also was I believe, the major cause for him ending the term early. And for all of you at home who are trying to figure out how you could take a couple days of vacation, realize that the House is now on vacation through September, to the beginning of September. So while the Congress and Johnson certainly have criticized the European work ethic, they certainly vacation like the Europeans do, taking all of August and most of July off. Couple issues I'll toss on the table and see what my other panelists think of it. I think the most serious issue here isn't just the whole Epstein cover-up. It's the fact that Johnson has sold out both the Constitution and the fiduciary responsibilities of Congress to act as a balance of power against the executive that bothers me most in this whole story. That nowhere and at no point in time has Johnson done what I believe he should have been doing, whether it's the emergency tariffs, use of emergency executive orders, certainly manipulation of the agenda, which is common from the speaker, but still at the extent that he's done it is noteworthy. It allows the president and his minions the capacity to continue to go on and do what they want, unfettered by the balances and protections that the country need. I'll also foreshadow what I think is going to be part of the conversations that we're going to have in September, and that's the fact that we're staring down a better than average chance for a government shutdown because of the way the speaker and certainly the way the Senate have acted. So this early dismissal, even with the agendas not completed, bodes poorly for what's going to come in September.
Mark Grimm. I don't know why my microphone is off. Mark Grimm.
Well, in politics, when you're losing, you change the subject. And that's what the Democrats have done. The truth is, President Trump has had a pretty remarkable success story here in the first year of his second term. He did get the bill passed, and it was a very controversial, the big bill. I don't call it the big, beautiful bill. It was a messy bill. It was a complicated bill. He was managed to get that passed. He's had significant victories ultimately in the Supreme Court. And he's also had some foreign affairs victories. Now, what is Speaker Johnson doing? I think the Democrats, there's some disagreement among themselves. So he's looking for a cooling off period. So that's why I'm sure that's why they left early. But the fact of the matter is the border, the change in the border is unbelievable. The change from open borders under Biden to now almost no illegal immigrants are crossing the border. That's pretty remarkable.
But he's not talking about that.
About the successes that Trump has had, and then the Democrats are focusing on Epstein. It's funny. The left criticizes the right as right-wing conspiracists, but now they're saying, oh, yeah, no, there is a conspiracy for Epstein. I don't know what the Epstein story is. I don't think anyone really does. Okay. So let it roll out. And as a former investigative reporter, I'm for transparency over non-transparency. So I want to know what's in the Epstein files.
So just with all due respect, let me just ask this question.
Okay.
Because as far as I know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it was Pam Bondi who announced that the binder was on her desk and it was going to be released. It was not until that it was not released, and it was not until there were questions from the MAGA base who revolted over that information not being that information not going out, is when the Democrats started to join and say, is there something here? I don't know how you blame that on the Democrats when it is the Republicans who said, oh, we have all this information. They ran on it. They ran on it for the campaign. We have all this information. We're going to get it out there. We're going to be transparent. And then something happened, and we are no longer going to be transparent.
The issue is, what should be the top priority? The Democrats should be focused, as the Republicans are, in my view, on what has been left with all the illegal immigration. In fact, we had a situation in New York City where an ICE officer was just enjoying the summer night. He was shot, allegedly, and one of the assailants had been arrested four times and released. That is the state of affairs in New York State, which we have to live with every day. So that's what the focus should be. I believe the Epstein files, if they're not released, they're going to be leaked one way or another. So we're going to find out what the situation. I don't know what the story was with Epstein, and you don't either. But I do think that information is going to come out. It's just not going to come out right now.
Well, I think it's smart for the Democrats to jump on this Epstein issue. You know, for so long, they haven't really had the upper hand on anything. And this is an opportunity to take Trump down. And I wouldn't say it's like, you know, conspiracy theory thinking. They're asking something that a lot of Americans are also asking, right? Which is, what is in these files? And why is Trump suddenly pivoting from also demanding transparency for so long, really? Last year, just 2024, he was asking for a transparency, and now he's backing up. And in really peculiar ways, right? Like, the lady doth protest too much in this situation. This is someone who has been, you know, bragging about, you know, his own good health, his commitment to transparency, and, you know, he likes to present himself in a particular powerful way. And in the last week, he has been switching, right? He's been trying to gain public sympathy for his health condition, which is so bizarre because he's so insistent on presenting himself as being really in good health and, you know, recovering from COVID rapidly and from doing really well on cognitive tests. I think showing that kind of, weakness or highlighting things like, and I'm sure we'll talk about this extensively later, pivoting to Obama, these are all desperate attempts to get people to look away from this issue, which means maybe we should look even closer, right? If he had, you know, and what really surprised me is, there was another way Trump could have dealt with this Epstein issue. There is a long record of them being friends. And there recently, they released photos of Epstein at attending Trump's 1993 or 1994 wedding to Marla Maples, Is that her name? Marla Maples. Yes. Yeah. And their friendship fell apart somewhere around early 2000s over some real estate in Florida. Now, Trump could have used that opportunity to say, you know, I have not been friends with this man because of his outrageous behavior. And after I learned about, you know, all the terrible things that he's done, I ended that friendship. I ended those relationships. That would have presented him in a much better light, right? I feel like that was a real lost opportunity for him strategically to say, I purposefully ended my association with this man after I got even a whiff of what he was doing with these with sex trafficking, right? But he didn't do that. Instead, he asked for transparency, and suddenly he flipped, which only creates greater suspicion, and we should be suspicious. I you know, it's unusual behavior or suspicious behavior. Yeah.
I'm intrigued by your position, Mark. This did not look like a victory lap to me. This looked like an absolute act of desperation. I thought it was unusual, and I thought it drew actually more attention to the Epstein situation. And again, I'm not gonna fault the Democrats either. Why let a good crisis go to waste? And the more that comes out of about the situation with Epstein and Trump, I think the more questions that it's raised. And I'll go back to your comments, Joe. Remember what's happened with this administration in the Epstein case. Bondi talked about the thousands of documents that were made available. She did the whole dog and pony show of bringing the right wing influencers into the White House and into the Department of Justice to give them their own binders of materials that had already been released. She came out stating that the documents were on her desk, and then came back and after the pressure grew, said, "Oh, by the way, the documents don't exist." And I think this is part of the pressure that you're seeing with the current administration right now is that if you look at historical comments or comments that have been made in the past by both the director and the deputy director of the FBI about the Epstein case, by Bondi about the Epstein case, by members of Congress, including Johnson, about the Epstein case versus what they are being told to do or what they appear to be being told to do and they are now doing versus what they talked about as far as transparency and releasing documents, that it's so wildly different that we as a people deserve the right to understand what exactly is going on.
We're going to take a break. We'll continue this conversation after, on the other side of the news. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will continue after this break and news from the BBC. Paranoid this morning as we remember Ozzy Osbourne. Born John Michael Osbourne, died yesterday at the age of 76, and we'll be playing Ozzy Osbourne throughout the morning as bumper music, coming into our panel segments. You can find out the complete list of tracks by going to our playlist, wamc.org/roundtable, wamc.org/roundtable. All right, so let's get to another part of the story, which I think is just to add to it and to put it into some further context. That is that a spokesman for former President Barack Obama said that while the office does not normally dignify the constant nonsense and misinformation flowing out of this White House with a response, the Trump administration's new bizarre and ridiculous allegations warranted one. Obama's office said that Trump's administration's treason claims are a distraction. On Friday, Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard, whose position has traditionally been apolitical, released declassified documents that she said showed Obama and his national security team, quote, manufactured and politicized intelligence to lay the groundwork for what was essentially a years-long coup against President Trump. The evidence pertains to the intelligence community's conclusion that Russian President Vladimir Putin decided to interfere in the 2016 presidential election on Trump's behalf. The evidence on which Gabbard based her findings is paper thin and discounts more substantiated intelligence findings. The Washington Post fact checker found, but Trump has nonetheless embraced the material as the basis for potential criminal prosecutions against his perceived political enemies, and that includes, of course, Barack Obama. A spokesman for Obama said in a statement that while the White House does not normally dignify the constant nonsense, that they felt this was so bizarre and ridiculous that it warranted one. Nothing in the document issued last week undercuts the widely accepted conclusion that Russia worked to influence the 2016 presidential election, but did not successfully manipulate any votes. These findings were affirmed in a 2020 report by the bipartisan Senate Intelligence Committee, led then by Chairman Marco Rubio. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Obama office referring to the Trump Secretary of State. Multiple in-depth investigations found that Russia interfered with the 2016 presidential election, largely in an attempt to interfere with U.S. democracy, but also in a way that suggested Putin preferred Trump to win the presidential race. Earlier Tuesday, Trump said a criminal investigation should move forward. As a result of the findings, it's time to go after people, he said. Trump signaled out Obama, who he said had been caught directly. Anyone?
I mean, how bad is this Epstein thing for them? So it's just so surprising, because why even draw attention to Russia's involvement, right? If the thing that they're trying to distract is somehow worse than that, like, why even bring something like this back up? Especially, it does not make Trump look good, right? Like, the study found that Russia did not actually interfere with the election systems, but instead it attempted to influence the election outcome, favoring Trump. So it does not make sense to me why he would want to draw attention to this again, because it's incriminating to him. At the same time, if this is considered treasonous, wouldn't his actions while Obama was president be considered treasonous as well? Because he was falsely accusing Obama of not being born in the United States and thus not eligible to be president. So I don't see how this is all that different from that. So if we're saying, I mean, there's no evidence of any of this from Gabbard's report, but Trump could easily be accused of the same sort of treason.
Mark?
Let's back things up a little bit. The Russian hoax. It was just that. It was a hoax. And that the FBI relied on bogus research, which was generated on behalf of Hillary Clinton's campaign, to frame Trump for colluding with Russian election meddling. It didn't happen. And yet this story went on and on and on. And no one really paid the consequence for this. For this fake, you know, you talk about fake news, and Trump overuses that term, I'll agree. But this was classic case of fake news. So now, on one hand, we're complaining that they're not releasing the Epstein files. Here, Tulsi Gabbard did release the files. So the question is, what exactly was Obama's role in this? That's what I think we need to know. And for the sake of transparency, we need to know more about that. because it's very clear now that the Russian collusion between Trump and Putin was just plain false.
So a couple of different issues here, right? I mean, if you, Mark, you're talking about the Steele dossier versus
the whole collusion that Trump was in colluding with Putin. It didn't happen.
That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about, though, is the Russian attempts to interfere in the 2016 election. So there's the Steele dossier. Okay, let's put that to aside. But there's also bipartisan support for findings of attempted manipulation by foreign governments, including Russia, to manipulate our elections. Okay, they weren't able to get into the voting systems themselves, mm-hmm. but they did use other processes to try to influence how Americans view both the government and the election. All right, so that's what Gabbard came out with saying is part of the treason from Obama. This is in my mind absolute deflection. Mm-hmm. I think it has as much to do with the fact that for the first time since 2015, the MAGA base is significantly questioning Trump and what Trump is doing. And this plays right back to the base. It plays back to the narrative that you know Obama is a crook and that there's this
that there's this whole
deep state. I'll also note that the findings in the report that Rubio helped sign off on when he was in the Senate were developed through the Trump administration and the officials that were in place. So Chris Krebs at Department of Homeland Security, the Trump's former ODNI, Office of Defense Intelligence. This is so it's really interesting now that Gabbard is coming out this way, but it doesn't surprise me. Gabbard is the rumors in D.C. is that she's been on the chopping block, that he's very unhappy with her. So anything she can do to stay in Trump's good graces is something that she's going to do. And again, it's playing back into the woe is me, ignoring the fact that what the Rubio report said was there was foreign attempts for foreign governments to interfere within our elections, and it's something that we as a country need to address and watch for.
And every Republican signed off on that too.
They did. Yeah. It was a bipartisan report.
10 years later, the current president of the United States is alleging the former president of the United States committed treason. Seems a very serious charge, number one. Two, 10 years, really?
Well, and again, he continues to talk about the election being stolen in 2020. And he is under incredible pressure, and anything that he can do, and this is a pattern that we've seen with Trump, is it deflect, throw stories out there, get the base to look elsewhere, and really that's what I think this is all about.
And this is one of those stories that his base loves to obsess over, right? Like election fraud. That's one of that's their bread and butter. So of course this is something he would like to, you know, throw into the lion's den to distract them from the other things that are going on. But a month long vacation or summer break, that is, if they think a month is going to encourage people to forget about the Epstein files, I mean, they are mistaken.
What is the issue here, Bob, to speak to what you defined as the issue? The issue is not that Putin is bad. Oh, he's bad. He tries to poison his people that disagree with him.
Mm-hmm.
And did he try to meddle in the election? I think that's very likely. The question is, what role did Obama play in the Russian hoax? That's an important question that has not been answered.
And, well, they're not coming
maybe
up
these
with
documents
much.
Will, maybe they won't. Mm-hmm. But, you know, here we release documents. On one hand, you say, well, you're not releasing the Epstein documents, but the Gabbard documents are being released. And whether it's treason or not, to Joe's point, is a whole other story. But I really would like to know definitively what role Obama or his administration played in the Russian hoax, which was a terrible moment to me in American history, because it was all pretty much made up.
I don't understand the hoax part, Bob.
Well, it's the difference between again. There's two elements here. There's the Steele dossier that came out that was all of salacious, you know, stories about Trump in Moscow with, you know.
You may have referred to it as the P-tape.
Yes. I wasn't sure if we could still use those words. But then there was also a bipartisan deep dive by a Senate Select Committee into the interference. Okay, and that again was signed off by Rubio, and what I feel is that Gabbard again is trying to intertwine these two issues, and trying to paint the fact that Obama was, and I think still is. And a lot of people in the federal government remain concerned about interference of foreign governments into our elections. All right, and she put out, I think, the documents that she put out that have been released before. This isn't new. What's new is that she put a level of analysis that people are really questioning the veracity of, and some of her conclusions are truly questionable. So these are the multiple issues. I'd also throw another issue on the table, Joe, which I find fascinating with this whole thing, is that given the Supreme Court's I thought faulty decision to create almost carte blanche immunity for the president, I would imagine that would be the same for any president, not just Trump. So, you know, it would also apply to the actions of Obama, should that have been the case. Now, Mark, one thing I agree with you. Yeah, I do want to know, and I think we should know. We should understand what our elected officials are doing. And what decisions are being made, and I feel that as the government, we have become way too opaque in how decisions are being made, in the impact of those decisions, and frankly in the accountability of decisions that have gone wrong, and understanding where decisions have gone wrong in the past, and I think it's an enormous problem for the country right now.
And yeah. By the way. This applies to local governments as well. I can give examples in the Albany County Legislature, where I'm fighting for transparency all the time there, and sometimes I feel it's a losing battle. But it does seem that no matter who's in office, I mean, the Democrats began this by prosecuting political opponents. This was Trump, and now people are surprised that the Trump administration is looking into, you know, it's almost the Democrats, for example. The Senate rules were changed to allow 51 votes for federal judges. That was done when the Democrats were in control, mm-hmm. not thinking that at some point the Republicans would be in control and they could use the 51 votes. We'd never get a Supreme Court nominee through now with 60 votes. So both sides have to realize that what goes around comes around, and we're going to continually, especially in a 50-50 nation, we're going to continually see one party in, one party out, and you know, I think there's been way too much attempts to prosecute elected officials. At the same time, you know, you look what Hunter Biden did. I mean, good grief.
So far, I think the worst thing that Hunter Biden has ever done is that interview over the weekend.
That and the millions of dollars.
I don't know if anyone has seen that, but there are actually two of them. But one of them's on tape, and oh my God.
Somebody who should have just gone away quietly.
But Joe, I think there's an important point here though, and it ties back with the whole Epstein file. All right, you know, from my standpoint, okay, I don't care whether, you know, what I care about is the fact that underage children were sexually trafficked.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that powerful people have been protected and have not been held accountable. And I don't care whether you're a Democrat or Republican. Okay. If you were on the list, if you were part of that, okay, then you should be held accountable. In that right now the justice is not being served because of money and power. So I don't care if Trump's on the list. I don't care if Clinton's on the list. If either of them are on the list, then they should be held accountable, and they should be forced to pay the restitutions, including potential incarceration for the crimes they committed. And that's that to me is the bottom line. And frankly, it's the one area where I have a great deal of empathy and cross party support with folks on the MAGA right, is that the only way you address this is by become clean with it, put the information out, and then holding those people accountable.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we have many letters on this. Surprise! We'll go to those and take a break. And we'll be right back after this. After 9 o'clock. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Today it's Ozzy-rific. And we welcome you. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. And we get to a lot of letters on the issue that we have been talking about this morning. We begin with Marion, who is, I don't know where Marion's from, but that's okay. My understanding is treason is colluding with the enemy in a declared war. Without a declared war, there is no treason. Whether and whoever broke the law, can we stop using the charge of treason, which is punishable by death? That from Marion. Then we go to Sherry. The victims know the truth. Listen to them. Believe them. Then we check in with Warren. Go ahead.
And Joe, while you're looking up the next one,
while I'm fumpering.
I think this is a really important point that the victims of this crime have been successfully silenced, mm-hmm. And the fact that they were not believed. They have been harassed. I think this whole Epstein rot, it goes much deeper than we know, which is exactly why I think I agree with Massey from Kentucky, who I don't agree with a lot of things with him, but in this one there should be a special counsel that we should be getting to the bottom of this.
Yeah, I agree with you, Bob. This, you know, for many weeks now, we have made this a Trump issue or a Democrat hoax issue. But to your earlier point, this really is about a very serious problem, which is sex trafficking, and especially underage children. Children, this is the thing that we should focus on. And you're right, like, transparency, it doesn't matter if the people on that list are Republican, Democrats. It really doesn't matter. But we need to know who is on that list and hold them responsible.
Back to the letters we go, and we check in with David. I almost spit coffee all over my keyboard. Thanks. When your panelists accuse the Democrats of changing the subject by focusing on the Epstein scandal, talk about gaslighting. Wow. It wasn't the Democrats who ran on exposing the Epstein files. Who's trying to change the subject? The president. How about his comments yesterday accusing Obama of sedition or treason? What does your panelists think about that? And I will certainly let you say more, Mark, although we did discuss that.
Yeah, I mean, what I said stands as far as I'm concerned. Yeah.
One,
I'm glad they have all their opinions. That's fine.
Raina says one wonders what is in the Epstein files that scares Trump so badly that he feels the need to use his nuclear option of calling Obama a traitor. It has to be something beyond comprehension. That was a thought you alluded to, Catherine. Then we go to James. Trump asked Russia to help find Hillary's emails on television in front of the whole world, in front of everybody. Explain how Russia interference is a hoax. This is a MAGA cult misinformation. That from James. Then we go to Leonard. He has you talking about Obama. I think that's you, Mark. The subject is Donald touching young girls. Then we go to, who do we go to? We go to Ray. This is so obvious a cover-up because everyone knows that Trump is implicated in this. Once that was apparent, it's funny how all the papers disappeared or were unavailable. Secondly, Trump's remarkable immigration work was most accomplished by skirting law and constitutional rights of people.
And Joe, can I just jump in with the concern that I have? A concern I have is that records are not being kept in accordance with the rules and regulations, and that files are or could disappear. And this is certainly something that I had a lot of faults with Merrick Garland, but I always felt that at the end of the day the law was what he would follow, and I do worry about some of the folks not only Bondi, but the folks around Bondi, about what they're doing with these records. And again, I'm going to repeat this because I think it's important. This isn't just a Donald Trump issue. When you look at some of the names that have been associated with Epstein, whether they're other politicians, whether they're billionaires, whether they're high profile attorneys, whether they're potential heads of state, the list is numerous, and there's a lot of power behind them.
Another Bob who writes to us agrees with you. The Jeffrey Epstein case is about the global elite exploiting and abusing vulnerable children for their entertainment. Both Republican and Democratic politicians are complicit in this cover-up. They are beholden to those that fund their campaigns. Then we go to Justin. The thing I always go back to with the hoax line of defense is, did Donald Trump go on live TV and ask Russia to release dirt on Hillary Clinton? And did WikiLeaks release said dirt in the following days with the help of Trump's buddy Roger Stone? Criminal liability aside, there was a lot of connections between the campaign and Russia. Not criminal, but untoward, for sure. The Steele dossier was a totally different scandal. And that'll bring us up to the top of the hour. We'll go over to a break and get news from our news buddy, Ray Graff. And we'll be back right after this. I've seen your face 100 times. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Let me remind you who is on our program: Bob Griffin, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. Mark Grimm, professional speaker, speaking coach, and Albany County legislator. And Catherine Tan, associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College. We welcome your letters, panel, at wamc.org. panel@wamc.org, and we would love to hear from you. Let us move on to other subjects and talk about other things on this Wednesday morning. We now move on to trade and to deals and to tariffs, and we look at both Japan as well as Canada. We begin with Canada. No, we begin with Japan, I want to do, where Trump says that the U.S. has struck a trade deal with Japan. He says the U.S. has agreed to a massive trade deal with Japan, massive, quote unquote, one of the country's largest trading partners. Japan has agreed to invest $550 billion in the U.S. while its goods sold to America would be taxed at 15% when they reach the country below the 25% tariff that Trump had threatened. Trump said on social media that Japan would open its economy to U.S. goods, including cars, trucks, rice, and certain agricultural products. Japan's prime minister welcomed the announcement, saying it was the lowest figure to date among countries with trade surpluses with the U.S. Trump touted at a White House event on Tuesday, "I just signed the largest trade deal in history. I think maybe the largest deal in history with Japan. They had their top people here, and we worked on it long and hard, and it's a great deal for everybody. I always say it has to be great for everybody. It's a great deal." The tax is above the 10% levied on Japan and other countries when he suspended higher so-called reciprocal tariffs between April and July. A quarter of Japan's U.S. exports are from its critical automotive sector, which accounts for almost 3% of its economy. Who would like to start us off?
Why would they want our cars and trucks? Right now, in Japan, less than 1% of people own American-made cars. Like, we like their stuff. I don't know. I mean, aside from the agricultural products, I don't know if they want our cars and trucks. That seemed a bit silly.
Bob?
I mean, I will admit that I understand the need for tariffs, but I don't like the way the tariffs are being used right now. The deal is interesting in a couple of different reasons, and you know you just hit I think a really good point about the market for U.S. automobiles in Japan is very different than the market for Japanese vehicles in the United States. Although I'll note that there are multiple plants now in the United States that are building Japanese brands. I'm thinking Honda and Toyota. There is still an issue of parts, and you know I do want to sort of conflate this also though with the Canada situation, Joe, because there has already been a howl coming out of the major U.S. automakers about this deal, saying that even at the 15% point, it helps the Japanese automakers and continues to hurt the United States big three. And I saw a number this morning that GM paid $1.5 billion in additional money for tariffs on parts made in both Mexico and Canada. So there's this sort of multi-level chess that's going on with this. A couple of the things about the trade deal that I think are important, and I haven't seen all of the details. The issue of our agriculture being able to be sold, our agricultural products being able to be sold at a fair rate in Japan has been a longstanding problem, particularly rice, but also soy and other products. I don't know how expansive the agreement is. That's something that I'm going to be interested in looking at. It's still though, the 15% tariff though. Is something that is going to impact people in the United States. And again, I think this is one of my bigger problems with tariffs and across the board tariffs is that the cost of the tariffs eventually, the cost of the tariffs trickle down more to the consumer on the street, certainly than the proverbial tax breaks do.
And I'm not, I'm not an economist and I would never want to be one. But with the tariffs, my question is, okay, clearly this is something that's going to the higher cost is going to be passed on to the American consumer. It doesn't, and the idea is that it would encourage things to be made here in the United States. The idea is that it would encourage business growth within our country. And it disregards the fact that our reality is highly globalized. You know, nothing is, very few things are, can be made 100% in the United States. So with the tariffs passing the cost on to consumers, it doesn't necessarily mean that this is going to lower the cost of American-made goods, right?
No, I think just the opposite. And I think part of the concern that I have is I'm all for American, increasing American manufacturing.
Sure.
But the window to do that, and Mark, you from your experience on the Albany legislature, you can speak to it. It takes years. I mean, literally years in order to build facilities, get them up and running,
right,
making sure you've got the trained workforce. And there's this, in my mind, there's this sort of gap between where we are right now with the tariffs versus where we want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly, again, I'm fully supportive of our government incentivizing companies to remain in the United States with manufacturing, bring back manufacturing, support American manufacturing. Understanding though that there's that when other countries do it, you have to sort of say, yeah, we're doing something similar. So there is a timeline, but there's also the issue that we're seeing with just raw materials and right, things like that, the heavy metals and honestly, there's some production that we depend on international partners to do it because, frankly, we don't want it done here.
Right. Let me just get in the tariffs. It's just fundamental fairness. If a country wants to charge a 15% tariff on you, you should be able to charge a 15% tariff on them. And that hasn't been the case. This is really a case, I hate to use the slogan, putting America first, but this is really a case of being fair to us. And it hasn't been fair for a long time. And we're in the catbird seat. As of 2023, consumer spending by the U.S. was $18.8 trillion. For China, it was $7 trillion. And for Canada, $1.2 trillion. So we're the customer. And that's leverage. And we should use that leverage to protect our interest. And the tariffs, ultimately, when you have more trading, that eases pressure on prices because there's more options for consumers. So the tariffs, I think it's a positive step. It is tricky. You have to, especially when it comes to precious metals, stuff like that, there's certain things we have to, we can't rely on China for our drugs, mm-hmm, our precious materials. So it's very complicated. But I think the idea of reciprocal tariffs is a fair idea, and I'm glad we're bringing it to the floor, but I also recognize it's a little risky, and particularly for the time frame that you outlined, Bob. But yes, we need to manufacture more in the U.S. just because it creates more jobs for our folks.
But
also,
mm-hmm,
the supply, we've gone through the supply chain thing and all that kind of stuff, too.
But in the U.S., the kinds of jobs that we're hoping to bring back are, you had mentioned manufacturing, agriculture. Well, who wants to fill these jobs? A lot of these jobs are filled by immigrants, and there are so many immigrant hostile sentiments and policies that are floating around right now. So I don't understand how these two things can sit together with the country, with the current administration being so anti-immigrant, but at the same time wanting a lot of jobs that many Americans don't want, or they are too credentialed or educated to take?
Well, first of all, there's a lot of educated people that want to be in manufacturing, and there's a lot of Americans that want those jobs. And Trump has said, we recognize the hotel industry, the farming industry relies on immigrants that are not here legally. That's a reality. But I do think we should be pushing towards a path of legal immigration. Right now, we flaunt the law and say, illegal immigration is okay. In fact, Biden let in millions and millions of people. Many of them just want a better life. A good number of them are criminals that are harming our citizens. So, but the tariff, going back to the tariff issue, I think we should give it a try. And understand that Trump is a longtime businessman who's dealt with international business. So he has a resume that probably most presidents don't have.
I think it's a little unfair to say many are criminals. Like, studies have shown that immigrants are less likely than American citizens to commit crimes.
That's no reason to let in. We know, for example, there's thousands of murderers. We know that there's people been arrested and let go. This is particularly a point in New York State where we have a pro-criminal legislature. They're more concerned about passing laws to protect criminals than they are protecting victims.
But there are more people being deported without criminal records than are being deported with criminal records.
While we need to narrow on the dangerous people, the human traffickers, the drug dealers, the violence, that definitely should be our focus. There's no doubt about it.
But that's certainly not what ICE is doing right now. But if I could go back to terrorists, and this is where this
cool. And then can I talk about Canada?
Yes, absolutely. but you know, there's also the issue of I don't want to just look at tariffs as a zero sum conversation. You know, tariffs also are ways that we support our allies, and I think the shotgun approach that we've taken, and I understand the negotiating position, saying, well, you know, I'm going to threaten 25%, I'm going to get 15%, and look at this great deal. It's still 15% on one of our staunchest allies in an area that we desperately need to make sure we're preserving our alliances. So you start to think about Japan, you start to think about Korea, South Korea, you're starting to think about the Philippines, Vietnam. These are all part of our sort of or were part of our strategic alliances in combating the expansion of China. All right, so unfortunately, we're just talking, you know, tariffs as if they're a standalone. It's part of a web of both economic but also diplomatic tools that as a country that we need to have. And there are some tariffs that were unfair to the United States in that we accepted because we recognize what it did is that it helped support the host nations in ways that also benefited the countries, our countries, the United States, diplomatic and national security goals. And I don't want that to get lost in the whole conversation. Being a good friend and neighbor pays off, particularly in times of crisis, which is a segue right back to Canada, Joe, because we are not being a good friend and neighbor to Canada.
And Canada seems to know this in looking at their response. They say with less than a week left for Canada to reach a trade deal with President Trump or face additional tariffs, Prime Minister Mark Carney on Tuesday downplayed the possibility of a breakthrough and suggested that Canada might walk away empty-handed. Mr. Carney spoke after an emergency meeting of Canada's 10 provinces and 3 territories that he convened in response to Mr. Trump's threat to impose 35% tariffs on Canadian exports starting August 1st. Asked about the likelihood of reaching a pact by that deadline, Mr. Carney said that we'll agree to a deal if there's one on the table that is in the best interest of Canadians, but then later added in French that it's not our objective to have an agreement at any cost.
Well, I just think Canada's $1.2 trillion and we're $18.8 trillion. So we have the advantage. And by the way, some of the things that are being negotiated, the tariffs, they take into account, Bob, the importance of having strong allegiances in particular areas. That's why every one of these countries is a different negotiation. And that's a good thing, that there is a value in having a steady ally, particularly in certain areas of the world. But Canada has to realize it's like they're the little brother trying to flex their muscles against their big brother. we're the big consumer, and yes, they should do what's in their interest, but the U.S. is going to put America's interest first, and it seems to me these two men can come to an agreement where both feel that way.
Yeah, and I look at it a little bit differently. I look at it as that I don't disagree with the numbers. The numbers are what they are. It's the fact that I've prided myself on the fact that the United States has not been a bully, that it doesn't have to strut its stuff. It doesn't have to hold military parades to prove to the world how strong it was. That the virtue of the United States was as much as in its ideals as it was in its technology and its military and economic strength. And I would argue that our economic strength was actually even more important globally than our military, which is by far the strongest. And I feel that the way Trump has gone about this is that he's created a zero-sum conversation. He's been both dismissive, patronizing, and disrespectful to our allies, and this is going to, in the long term, bite this country right in the keister. Yeah, we're the strongest, but you know something? When you act like a bully, and then you start to see a shift in the world order, including a move away from the dollar as sort of the global monetary standard. These are all things that in the next 10 to 20 years is going to weaken this country.
And I don't know how strong he's coming off, because the negotiations with like Canada and Colombia, Mexico, haven't these things been going back and forth for months now? He's been adjusting the numbers for
years.
Months?
I mean, this is tariffs are not a new problem. It's just Trump is the first one to do something about it.
Well, but I disagree with that. I would argue that the economy that Trump inherited was much stronger than the economy that Trump has now. But I'll also note that this is kind of in keeping with his financial record. I mean, I think he's got, 11 bankruptcies under his belt, which is also probably a record for U.S. presidents. The agreement that he doesn't like with both Mexico and Canada was the one that he negotiated in his first term. So I mean, again, these things get lost in this whole conversation about if that was such a bad deal, then why the hell did you agree to it then?
Right.
Well, just on the bully thing, yeah. I understand the personality deficiencies that the president has, and I can't deny those.
Yeah, that was kind.
So it's frustrating when he's, Mr. Bravado. Yeah. But he is a negotiator, and it's time for – I do think we should understand our position of strength in negotiation and take advantage of that. And I don't think that's being a bully. That's doing what – putting America first when it comes to hard-knock negotiation. In other countries, they feel the same way. I understand that. But they don't buy $18 trillion worth of goods every year.
Yeah, I guess having been able to do some international work when I was at Homeland Security, none of our partners ever forget that we're the 800-pound gorilla. But we don't need to pound our chests to remind them of that.
Agreed.
And in part, what made us, I think, stronger is the fact that we had alliances and partners that we could go to without question. And I think of the relationship with Canada as one of those relationships. It is much more as a sibling partnership relationship, but anybody who is a younger sibling, if your older sibling continues to put their finger in your chest and tell you that you're not worthy and that you need to listen to your older sibling, I don't know anybody who listens to that, and that doesn't go well for family dynamics.
I'm one of nine kids, so I can agree to that.
Yeah, absolutely. and it's just and you look at it and you think that that's not the way to act as a family. And,
but those
and
are
frankly,
there's two different things, Bob. The way he handles the personality aspect of it, and the way he handles really hardcore negotiation, those are two separate things. And in the end, it's what's best for America, and that's the way it hasn't been that way. It hasn't been that way, and I wish Trump were more tactful. Okay, let's underscore that. But the reality is, I think the tariffs are moving in the right direction, even though, you know, it is pretty risky.
Yeah, and I think, and you and I can just agree to disagree that we are not a nation of victims, and I think we've accepted this victimhood story way too easily.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up with this group. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you. Bob Griffin, Mark Grimm, Catherine Tan, and your questions coming up, and more topics as well after this news update from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion on this Wednesday morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. A couple of letters I want to get to in regards to tariffs, and then we'll move on to other subjects, I promise. Bob says, one has to wonder how many of the American manufacturing jobs that tariffs are supposed to lead to will be filled by robots and automation. From what I understand, that will be the case in many of the new and repatriated factories.
That's actually a really important point, Joe, because if we're building factories and we're not putting the most recent technologies into them, the costs are going to be really prohibitive. And I think this is part of the challenge of tariffs is the costs of doing business in the United States versus in other places around the world. But I also believe that modern industrial facilities are going to have a lot fewer employees than what we think historically. A perfect example, you start to think about even the ports, our ports, which used to be very, very heavy in manpower and people working at the ports, now they're so automated that you're running a port with 300 people versus 5,000 people that you would have done 20 or 30 years ago.
We also have more tech people employed in the tech industry. I mean, people have to make the robots, they got to fix the things, they got to sell them, so. I know the Candle Makers Union were very upset when they invented the light bulb, but that was progress.
Ellen writes to us and says many Americans would be happy to work in factories and farms, but they would not be happy to do it at the wages that immigrants are working for. That from Madeline.
Yeah, and again, Joe, I'm sorry to jump in on this one. I'm not sure that's really the case, though. I'm not sure that there is a willingness to work in some of these fields, and this is a couple of different pressures, including the idea that I think as a nation we have devalued sort of the honest trade and trade work, but also that. This is really hard physical work, and I was still horrified at the comment that came out from at the secretarial level about Medicaid patients actually going to work in the fields because this is the type of work that is so physically demanding that a lot of people can't do.
Yeah, I agree. And for so long, we push people to get a college education, and I do believe everyone deserves access to education. Not everyone should have to go to college to get a good job. But for so long, as you pointed out, we've been pushing for specialization, expertise. And it's great that we have so many educated people, but these are the types of jobs that many people do not want to take. Many Americans perceive as being stigmatizing beneath their skill level. And at the same time, if we, I believe we have to pay people fair wages. I do, firmly. The reason why we have cheap products is because we don't stick to fair wages, right? So yes, if we do pay workers minimum wage, the things, you know, we should also anticipate that all of the things that we enjoy for, you know, being so cheap, they're going to go up in price quite a bit.
And that's going to affect the poor the most.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, let's go to another subject as we start to wind up this morning. Again, we welcome you, panel, at WAMC.org. So you remember the Trump concerns over the Kennedy Center in Washington and the fact that I believe he is still acting, the acting CEO of that, right? Is that true?
I thought so.
Or board chair, one of the two. I'll have to double check that. And so now Republicans are looking to rename the Kennedy Center Opera House. It's one of four theaters within the Kennedy Center complex. They're looking to rename that Opera House after Melania Trump. Republican members of the Appropriations Committee approved an amendment to a spending bill that would rename the venue after the First Lady. The proposal was introduced by Republican members of the House Appropriations Committee as part of a spending bill for the Department of the Interior, Environment, and related agencies. The legislation would require approval from the full House. Mr. Trump, who did not attend the annual Kennedy Center Honors Award ceremony during his first term, has shown fervent interest in the Performing Arts Center in his second, naming himself to chairman shortly after returning to office. He purged the Kennedy Center board of Biden appointees, ousted both of the center's longtime president and its chairman. By tradition, the First Lady serves as the honorary chair of the Performing Arts Center. Mrs. Trump recently attended a performance of Les Miserables at the center with the president. The amendment, which contained additional measures related to the environment, passed 33. Let me just say that again. The amendment, which contained additional measures related to the environment, passed 33-25 in a largely party line vote. Representative Mike Simpson, a Republican from Idaho and chairman of the House Interior and Environment Appropriations Subcommittee, introduced the amendment. Mr. Simpson said in a statement after the vote that naming the theater after Mrs. Trump, quote, is an excellent way to recognize her appreciation for the performing arts.
They really like to put their names on things, don't they?
Tends to be a family trait.
I think, you know, there's something comically, tragically beautiful about this little story. I also like how it's not super consequential compared to all the stuff that we've been discussing. Pierre Bourdieu, a French sociologist, wrote a lot on cultural capital. He said that cultural capital is something that you can exchange for other forms of capital, for status. But importantly, a feature of it is that it's not something you can seize, right? It's not something that you can inherit or just take. It's something that a person has to embody. And here we have an example of the Trumps trying to seize cultural capital, trying to elevate their status by being associated with the arts. But in their day-to-day lives, I don't think we have seen much appreciation for the arts. So this seems off-brand. Melania may appreciate the arts, but what has she done for it to deserve the Opera House to bear her name? You know.
Representative Shelley Pingree of Maine, the ranking Democrat on the House subcommittee, opposed the amendment. quote, it's just another assault in this whole lineup of the president taking control of the Kennedy Center. Ms. Pingree said in a phone interview, it seems outrageous to me. There's no public consensus around this. That also leads me to wonder, does the president plan to rename the entire Kennedy Center after himself?
It's very tacky.
I would just say, I'd like to see it be the Henry Johnson Center. So people in Albany can appreciate our war hero. But yeah, you can have the wife of the president getting the name the same. I wouldn't be for Jill Biden Center or the Melania Trump Center.
I think it's very similar to how he likes to gild all his homes and casinos. What was that famous, what was that quote? It's Trump is a poor man's image of a rich man or imagination of a rich man. And I think this is an example of that, in which Trump is trying to associate his name with things that he perceived to be high status or classy, right? Things that would elevate his position among his peers, among leaders in the world. And often it's things that you cannot buy, right? And here he's trying to buy status, which a person cannot buy.
Yeah, but I just, his
purchase.
Buildings, he puts the money up for all his buildings, and he wants to name them after Trump. Plus, he has a brand.
Yeah.
You know, I knew about the Trump Tower long before I knew really much about Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. But this, you know, a lot of people contribute to the center, and they're not named Trump.
Right.
You know, so the people in charge should name the people who should be named, naming rights should be, it should be based on how you've contributed to that asset.
To me, it's, asset is part of the... What I want to talk about, it's the butt kissing that's going on in D.C. and the whole cesspool that I think is D.C. right now. This idea that to curry favor, you're doing so many stupid things, and I question how these people get elected to Congress. It used to be that I held Congress up to a much higher standard, and I'm looking at both sides of the aisle, and I think I could sweep out everybody in elected to Congress right now and put an entirely new Congress in that would adhere to the principles of the country and actually deal with what's important in this country. And renaming the opera house at the Kennedy Center is nowhere near the top of my list.
No.
Can I just add something? Because we hear about the Republicans fall in line. It's the Democrats that are always straight ticket in the House. I mean, they rarely have one person stray away, where the Republicans, we've got the far-right caucus there that we're dealing with all the time. So I don't want to say butt-kissing.
Well, I'll call it butt-kissing.
Straight party-line votes are really more common among Democrats than they are Republicans.
Well, so they're good at whipping, but let me put it to you this way. I didn't see the Democrats trying to put Biden's face on the $100 bill or rename the Opera House after his immigrant wife or anything like that. I mean, there's just so much stupidity coming out of the GOP right now and the sycophantic actions towards the president there isn't a comparative example you can make with the Democrats. It really is distasteful.
Andrew Cuomo named the Tappan Zee Bridge after his father. I mean, that's ridiculous.
That's not down in D.C. I disagree with that, too.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I wasn't a big fan
actually,
of that.
Actually, it was Malcolm Wilson. My mom worked for Malcolm Wilson as a governor. He's a wonderful guy. And they just wiped him away and put his father in there. I mean, that's wrong. They're all wrong.
It's also one of the reasons why Cuomo's not governor.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, Michael. We're going to take a break and then we're going to come back. We'll finish up our conversation, and we will return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning as we finish up and have just a few more minutes with our group this morning, Bob Griffin, Mark Grimm, and Catherine Tan. And we welcome you. Any last minute letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Danny says, we are seeing red states rolling back child labor laws to accommodate necessary manufacturing rules. There was a claim on the panel that Americans want these manufacturing jobs and immigrants are taking them. Where is the objective evidence to support this? Seems like conservative Americans are willing to sacrifice the welfare of children to fill these roles when immigrant labor is not optional. I will say I don't think that came from the panel. I think it came from a letter, but that's to set that up.
But the letter writer is correct that there's some changes in child labor laws that I really disagree with. Mm-hmm. I point to Florida, that this idea that you could work all night and then be successful in school, I think is faulty and will create all sorts of societal issues that will take generations to fix.
Yeah, it sets up opportunities for exploitation. And yeah. how I actually don't remember, but what's the new age that they're considering?
What the Florida law allowed was for students in high school to work overnight.
Oh,
that was the one that specifically that really bothered me. So it really did roll back a lot of the child labor protections.
I could barely keep my GPA up during college while working, so I can't even imagine what this would do to kids in high school. It's a horrible idea.
Kate writes to us and says, "Dear friends, what a joy to hear intelligent, divergent views on the topic of the tariff negotiations. I appreciate the way you're putting forth your viewpoints. Reminds me of how we used to treat our friends on the other side of the aisle. Thank you for your thoughtful discussion this morning. Diversity without rancor."
Thank you.
Or at least not apparent rancor, right? thank you very much, Kate. We appreciate the kind words. So we've been playing Ozzy Osbourne this morning, and we learned yesterday that he passed away at the age of 76. He had been suffering from Parkinson's disease and a few associated neurological disorders as that go along with that often. But here was a very interesting, larger than life person who achieved enormous success as a pioneer of two wildly popular entertainment genres, heavy metal music, and then reality television. Let us not forget that. His family announced the death in a statement which did not say where he died or specify a cause. He had been treated in recent years for a variant of Parkinson's disease that he identified as Parkin-2, a condition exacerbated by his chronic drug abuse. Although Mr. Osbourne repeatedly announced his retirement over the years, he called a series of live dates in 1992 the No More Tours Tour, and then in 2018 series, the No More Tours Tour 2, he gave his final concert this month, the festival in his hometown of Birmingham, England, in his honor. Seated on a black throne, visibly moved by the enthusiasm of the crowd, he closed out his career by reuniting the original lineup of his heavy metal group, Black Sabbath. As the lead singer of Black Sabbath, Mr. Osbourne was one of the inventors of heavy metal. As a solo artist, he became a remarkably durable star with 13 platinum albums and the nickname, the Princess of Darkness.
The Prince of Darkness.
The Prince of Darkness.
Yes.
Excuse me.
It's okay.
Excuse me. Thank you. I was thinking
I think the princess was Elvira, so that was...
that would be interesting.
Yeah.
That sparks a whole other conversation.
Yes, there's a whole other conversation there.
I just want to go under a rock. But he achieved even wider fame for his rock and roll excess, including an onstage incident in which he bit the head off of a bat. That'll get you noticed.
Yep.
You know, it'll get you noticed, and it did. The hit MTV reality show The Osbournes presented a comedic counterpoint to his infamy and his taste for satanic imagery, revealing himself as the befuddled patriarch of a chaotic but loving family. He became a TV star. all the stuff on stage, the craziness, it's all just a role that I play. My work, Mr. Osborne insisted in an interview with the New York Times in 1992, I am not the Antichrist, I am just a family man. That is what he wanted to tell us in that show. And there was one more thing I wanted to include here. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame twice as a member of Black Sabbath in 2006 and as a solo performer in 2024. When he inducted Black Sabbath, Lars Ulrich of Metallica praised the group's huge Hymns of Doom. When it comes to defining a genre within the world of heavy music, he said, Sabbath stands alone.
Yeah, I mean, and it's really interesting to be able to look at somebody and can say, wow, that he was mostly responsible for that, for the whole genre. And I got to admit, Joe, this is, the heavy metal is not the genre that I typically listen to, but I appreciate what Black Sabbath and some of their music, but also what it grew into, you know, Metallica and AC/DC and Guns N' Roses and I think the music spoke to a population that was looking for something that was away from the soft pop of the 70s. Sort of in my mind, it was going sort of hand in hand with the early punk, and then the punk movement sort of split off. So as a sort of a amateur historian of rock and roll, I think it's a really interesting branch of the music, and had a profound impact on our societies in ways that we don't talk about an awful lot. It was also, I think, touching. I saw his reality TV show a few times. I can't say that I watched it regularly, but what struck me was, he was a decent family man, and he obviously had affinity and love for his family and children, which ran really contrary to that public persona.
I love the word that was used in the article of his patriarchal befuddlement, which certainly came across in the show.
I mean, I also this is not my genre, and I think my very first exposure to, you know, Ozzy Osbourne was the bat situation. I remember thinking as a kid, I was like, did that really happen? But I agree with you, Bob. The show really revealed or depicted a really nice, decent family guy. And to carry that contrast is really interesting.
A hard thing to do.
I'm not a heavy metal person. I like soft rock and romantic songs. You know, but what struck me at first, I thought this guy was really kind of weird. But as you got to know the family more, they really were kind of a typical family, which is really an unusual combination. But viva diversity. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what he represented the most.
Like shockingly traditional nuclear family.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, if you're going to be, like, you got to have, like, a rock star, and right? And that's a role, too.
Yeah, it was the persona, right? I mean, yeah. Led Zeppelin and the trashing the hotel rooms and the excesses of rock and roll. And it's one thing we don't talk about. What really sucks about getting old is that everybody you listen to is dead or dying. I think that's one of the most, as someone who really likes classic rock, it's like, wow,
That's one of the things that sucks about getting old.
Yeah, we're going to end on that
so
note.
Uplifting.
Just sucks to get old.
Be the alternative.
To all of you, Bob, Catherine, and Mark, thank you very, very much. We will continue our conversation after this short break.